sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
New record highs for markets. The VIX products are smoked. Goldman puts out a commodity warning and a big drop, they predict. And where do we go from here? That, the VIX, options, and lots more, especially for this Thanksgiving week. All this and much more on episode number 340 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And I'd like to say hello to you and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 344, the end of November 2013. There is Thanksgiving week to look forward to. In fact, the equity markets in the U.S. are closed on Thursday, and futures will be open for a partial day on Friday in the morning, I think till about, I guess about 1 o'clock Eastern. And there'll be also a shortened week coming up in a few weeks because, of course, the new year and the holidays. And one of the things we've noticed is that there has been a significant decline in not only the VIX itself, the VIX that everybody looks at for the volatility level, the reading by option traders on outward and expected volatility in the next 30 days or so, but we are also seeing something happening in the VIX products where individuals usually use ETFs and other instruments in order to invest. And in fact, the VIX is now at, what is it at now? 1225. Pretty significant when you think about it, because 15 was always that line that we had looked at as, well, you know, this is a pretty low VIX in terms of historical levels, and that means that there is an expectation or belief that volatility and usually downside moves of markets have disappeared. Now, oftentimes when you see something like that, you think, okay, well, is that an actual appropriate thing for investors to be looking at as a green light to invest more and more? Aptly, is it a signal that, wow, there's a lot of complacency in the markets? And you could probably go both ways on that. You could probably make a case for either side. But the fact is that with the Fed continually providing, unfortunately, mixed signals, but signals that they will continue with very low interest rates for a long time, whether or not they do the tapering or not anytime in the future, the fact remains, even if they cut the entire tapering in half or entire bond buying in half and only buy $35 billion per month, which now I think they're buying upwards of 70% of all of the bonds that are issued on the from the Treasury, well, they still have a 0 to 0.25% interest rate. Now, in times before this, when the Fed looked to have some kind of stimulus, they would just simply go and reduce rates. Let's say they were at 5, they take it down a quarter or a half percent, and that would be enough to at least level off the drop, if not the first time, the second time, maybe they even go down a few percent from where it was. And that would provide enough stimulus, along with oftentimes not only monetary policy, but you'd also have policy out of the government, whether it was tax relief or a change in a the unemployment benefits, or maybe they even go so far as bringing up some kind of a rebate that would come in the mail in the form of a tax rebate, or maybe even some other program that they would install temporarily to provide stimulus. But these days, we're not seeing any of the financial stimulus from the government. We're really just seeing only in terms of, well, we do have the unemployment rate, the unemployment insurance that is extended, of course, and we have the extended unemployment insurance that is out there as well. But aside from that, we're really not seeing anything from that side. We're really seeing that the entire load is being carried by the Fed. Okay, so we know that. Now, the Fed is been run by Bernanke for, it seems like forever, and now is the newcomer, Janet Yellen, which looks like everything is a big thumbs up for Janet Yellen, who arguably is as dovish as Bernanke is. And that means that when you look at the potential for any kind of significant move to remove stimulus, I don't really think that is going to be very, very possible in the near term. Now, when they were thinking about, like, you know, if you have on the other side, if you brought in, let's say, a Volcker or a Larry Summers or some other players out there, you may see that, yeah, well, a little bit more of a handle on the concern for not only inflation, but for bubbles to form and for excess assets to be purchased and risk of the Fed's balance sheet. You're not going to see that as much here. The fact is that there has been nothing that has been a problem so far. Think about it. You have, think back 5, 10 years. Think about if a company came out and announced that they would have a 1, 2, God forbid, a $5 billion charge or loss or a penalty from the SEC or anything, $5 billion of anything. What would happen to the stock? Think about it. It would plummet. It would get hammered for a while. On the other hand, let's focus on what happened recently. JP Morgan gets hit with, I don't even know if we can count them at this point, upwards of, is it close to $20 billion all told of potential penalties, charges, fees, and money they need to basically give back for some of the bad deeds they did back in the day. Now, why are they picking on this one versus the other? I think what they're doing is really focusing on one company and creating a blueprint for what they'll be doing to other banks. Already we're seeing that Bank of America has been getting some play here with this, you know, with the same kind of treatment. And now that JP Morgan has agreed to, okay, we'll pay this, and well, this precedent set, and because one bank and a major bank has now paid, I don't think any of the other banks have much of a leg to stand on when they're brought into the penalty box and have to pay whatever the fee is that they're going to have to pay. Now, again, we're talking about $15 to $20 billion that JP Morgan is going to have to pay. Did you see the stock drop? No. In fact, the stock's been doing pretty good. This is after not only having this massive penalty, but also the gigantic loss that they took on that. Remember in the earlier part of this year, they took a loss on that wrong way trade. So now we have $25 billion. $25 billion that this company has lost in the last year. And their stock has been in a general trajectory towards the bottom to the left to the top right of a chart. Pretty amazing change in sentiment and expectations for companies. And one of the reasons is, if you think about it, well, maybe this zero interest rate environment that they're in is allowing them to continually put money into their coffers at a rate that is much higher than any losses that they're taking. So they can lend money out, or they could just bring money in to pay for the amount of damages and not pay anything on it. The question remains, what happens when there is a increase in the Fed funds rate and that does negatively affect the banks? No wonder why the Fed is saying that we're not going to see a rise to interest rates for years to come, because if they did, they would have a major disruption in the banking industry. Massive disruption. And that's not what they're trying to accomplish. You know, the Fed is very financial institution centric. You know, a lot of the things that they do are all because of the financial institutions and the attempt to keep them healthy. Now, you can throw out an argument that it's a little bit too much. No other industry has the basically the explicit backing from an unlimited money opportunity. So, you know, if you have a Fed who could print money, you're in a level where there's nothing that could really happen here to the negative side. And that's why you didn't see any major companies besides one as a test go under. Or maybe they just couldn't help it at that point because it was so underwater. So what's happening here is that we are experiencing a moment in history where investors are believing that what happened 5 years ago, what happened 15 years ago, what happened 22 years ago, and what happens in cycles over and over again is never going to happen again. Because the Fed has trained all of us to, well, think, hey, you know what? They're going to be there for a while. Now, whether or not they're going to be is another story entirely. And if you notice that in their recent minutes that they put out this week, there was a discussion about the potential for a drawback in bond purchases. Markets did not react well. As a matter of fact, if you look at the TLT, which is the long-term bond ETF, or TBT, which is the inverse two times, we're talking about a 2.1% move to the downside on bonds. Rates came up very strongly because the anticipation over this is very much in the minds of investors, particularly those that have bonds, and they don't want to be in a situation where they're going to be left with bonds that are deteriorating in principal and very low yields. Can't blame them. So one of the problems you have right now is that bonds are at a relative high, and the potential for significant volatility in the near future to midterm future is very, very high, and the drawdown from your principal is very high. You have equities that have reached all-time highs in the U.S. Around the world, they're, you know, some are close, some are not on their markets, but you have equities that are at a relative high. You have P.E. ratios and earnings, and even if you look at a Shiller P.E. ratio or you look at whatever ratio you want, you're seeing a lot of excess excitement, bullishness by investors. As a matter of fact, the American Association of Individual Investors has out their regular, their polls and their charts, and bearishness has hit a low, or it's a pretty low number right now, and oftentimes you're seeing this kind of level of excitement where there is a lot of buying of retail investments, mutual funds that we talked about last week, and ETFs, and money rolling in. Buy on the dip mentality is out there, and there's hardly a bear to be found. Nobody's out there talking about anything. I mean, you don't see Rubini, you don't see any of these perma bears on any of the shows right now, and you don't even see any of the bulls that have turned bearish. That's a good sign, because that means that they're very much interested in putting money into the market themselves for their clients, of course. But valuations have to come into play. And we're just going to talk about this for one moment here. And we're going to move on to a couple other topics, because I think that what we're seeing right now is a little bit of a gaspy move. It may not be the end. Oftentimes markets will move to one side or the other in excess. But I will tell you something. The longer that this goes on, where we're seeing that every single earnings that misses is bought, or outlook that is much more subdued by companies is looked just as, well, you know what, they'll do better, we don't believe them, or that the Fed will always be there. Already we're seeing a lot of diminished results from the Fed's policies, and if we don't see any kind of significant pickup, well, what's going to happen is that if we see the economy continue to slip like we saw, that Europe, aside from Germany, Europe's numbers were awful. We're seeing that the Chinese numbers in terms of manufacturing have slowed again. We're seeing that the Philly Fed has dropped. Employment was a lot better, but we're seeing that manufacturing, factory orders, retail sales are just, they're just horrible. I mean, compared to the analyst estimates, maybe some of them have beat here and there, but you know what? If you look at the raw numbers, and you look at the growth, and you look at the actual numbers in terms of the economy, there's nothing to be excited about at all. See retail numbers at a plus 0.1? I mean, hello? You don't have an economy that is really growing, and if you don't have an economy that is growing, you don't have businesses that are growing. The only good news right now that really points to the continuation of an expansion is the assets that are rising do, in fact, have a positive implication to investor and consumer sentiment. So you get into this loop where you have assets rising or dropping, and investors become more confident. And because they become more confident when they're rising, you have them buying. And when they buy, assets rise. And when it rises, you have more confidence, and so on and so on. That just keeps on continuing in a never-ending loop until something breaks that. Now, oftentimes that loop will continue for a while because you have the non-believers, the believers, and then the ultra-believers. And once you have the non-believers in, you get that extra pop. And again, that's on the downside or the upside, and then you get what I would call an exhaustion move, where you see this, everybody's just, capitulating, moving in, whether it's a stock or a market, and they just kind of throw in the towel and say, okay, you know what, we're going to go along for the ride. And most of the time what that does is the reason why they call it an exhaustion move is for two reasons. It's an exhaustion move because can't do it anymore after that. And also it exhausts the amount of potential buyers or sellers that are out there. Now, when you look at a chart of a stock, and let's for a moment look and think about a short-term chart, because it will give us a lot better of a look here or a concept. Now, I want you to just think about this for a second, and you have a chart that's moving and moving up, and you see that the volume is picking up, maybe slowly. And let's pretend this is a stock that has a 30-minute chart. And you see these 30-minute charts, and they're really starting to build here, and the stock is really moving up, and it's actually moving up more and more. Each time, it's not pulling back much. It's moving up. And then all of a sudden, you have this big move higher with a violent spike in volume. A lot of participation, big spike in volume, big move in the stock. Now, let's take the opposite for a second, then we'll look at this and think about what this means. We have a stock that's moving down, and that moves down and moves lower, kind of may move up and down, of course, but that last bar that you find is this real significant drop and breakdown through a support level, and it's a long bar, and the volume bar is enormous, much bigger, maybe 2 to 3 times all other volume bars that you're looking at in the recent history. Now, what you see there is, again, that capitulation, that exhaustion, and a lot of times you want to look for that for two things. One, if there is a continuation of this, well, you may see significant downside if it's down, and up if it's up. But at the same time, look for near-term reversals on that, because these are usually times when you've exhausted all the sellers or all the buyers from the from their quest, and therefore you can't have the price support in either direction. And oftentimes you want to look for that, especially when you're seeing a stock that has been really trading very, very nicely, and this is more of an intraday thing, and very, very nicely to one side or the other, and then it just breaks with a lot of volume. And usually you find there's a short-term move to the other side, and then there could be a continuation of the prior trend or a move again, even lower or higher. Now, the volume is the key component here. It's also the width of the move. It's also the lack of any kind of move in an opposite direction. Well, right now we don't have a real exhaustion, a one-bar move, but you can point to the fact that you do see a tremendous amount of or lack of any kind of a pullback here. And I would say that while the potential for the December seasonality to kick in here, you know, at the same time, there is some talk about labor markets getting better and what's going to happen there with the tapering. The retail sales numbers may come in light because you have a very shortened period this year. And that's where retailers make most of their money, by the way, is during the holiday season, especially on a Black Friday, which they seem to be moving around. Now it's a Gray Thursday. So right now, one of the things that I would like you to think about, and this combines the discussion we had a moment ago about the VIX, which I want to pick up again in a second. It combines the VIX and the move that we recently saw. It also combines the whole concept of valuations will matter one day, is if you're thinking about, well, maybe it's time to put a little protection in the portfolio, or maybe even a contra trade or contra trend trade, you may want to think of options. Now, one of the options we just looked at and picked up was a SPY, so the S&P 500, 177 put for January. What that means is this is the strike price of 177, so the essentially on the date of expiration, the prices will be zero if the SPY is 177 or greater. Now, during that time, there is what we would call intrinsic value, which is the value of the differential between the strike price and the current price. So right now, the intrinsic value of that particular option is zero. And then you also have time value. Time value is the valuation of the expectation between that of time to expire and volatility of whether this is going to happen now. So there's a $2 baked in volatility and time premium put into this, about $2.10. So you can pick these up at about $2.10. Now, here's the thing, if you think about it for a second. So we're talking about the SPY, and we're talking about the S&P 500. We know the S&P 500 hit 1,800 on Friday, and the SPY, let's just call it, trading round number at about, let's call it 180, okay? 181. Now, if we need to, let's call it round number 181. It's a little bit shy of that, but let's call it round number 181. So if we think about that, that means that there is about $4 between now, the price currently, and the strike price. So we're talking about 2.2%. Now, between now and January, and particularly in the shorter term, is there potential for a 2% drawdown? Is there potential for a 1.5% drawdown? How about a 5% drawdown? If you think about that, it's really not that much of a risk here in terms of, I mean, you have to obviously pay the premium. But the risk is really not that great because we really have gone a long time without any kind of significant pullback. Now, whether or not that pullback lasts a day, a week, a month, you really have a total of about close to 50 days or so. That's days. You got to take out the weekends for trading days and for holidays, but maybe 40 days or so of trading. I think it's the 17th of January is when this expires. So if you think about that, you have all this time in there that the potential for, especially the beginning of the year, you have the potential for a drawdown. Now, obviously, the S&P can move higher, but if you have a drawdown and if the VIX moves higher, you're going to get a double benefit from owning this. Now, where can it go? Well, I mean, last week it was up about 15% at one point. Then it was down 15% at one point. This does have a lot of volatility because it's a low price situation. And of course, any kind of major move will have a significant impact in this option. And there's other options. I'm just picking this one because the time period was good. The valuation of it was good in terms of the time period and also the closeness it is to the strike. Because really, a 2%, they're only pricing this, if you think about this, a $2 premium on $180 security on almost a two-month period of time to have a 2% correction to get the strike. Now, of course, if you get the strike right away, you're going to be in great shape because you got a lot of time premium in there and time in there, and also you're going to have the volatility benefit and you're at strike. Of course, if you end up closer to the time, so let's say that the S&P and the SPY stay at the same value for the next, I don't know, 30 days, exactly at the same level, miraculously. Well, what will happen is that you're going to lose a lot of that excess time and get closer to the intrinsic value, which again is going to be zero at that point. And then if you have a breakdown, let's say that you have a breakdown on, let's say it's a day before the option expires. Essentially, you're going to have, if you buy it at $2, you're going to have $2 under 175, 177, which is 175. Now, 175 is only about, what is that now? That's a 3.5% drop from where we are. I mean, think about that for a second. That doesn't seem that hard to achieve, a 3.5% drop. We've seen it before almost on a monthly basis. We've had a period where there's been these kind of drops. It may have taken a few days to happen and then just 1 or 2 days to come back. But the opportunity to make a pretty penny on that kind of move, especially a fast move with options, are really get a significant move because what happens is option traders will bid that up on very, very quick moves. So if you see a very quick move, you're in really good shape. But even so, if you see a move that is protracted over the next, I don't know, 15 days, there is a great opportunity. Now, the VIX, let's talk about that because we talked about volatility here. One of the problems you're having with the VIX instruments is that the VIX itself has a significant amount of contango that is built in right now. In fact, looking at a chart that we put together, if you go and you take the VIX and you take, for example, the strike price at 14 and you look at the December price of it compared to the January price of it, the January price is significantly higher by about 150%. So what happens is that if you're in a VIX product, especially the VIX multiple products, that utilizes shorter-term VIX futures, What may be happening is that you're seeing that from this month, when the options and when they roll, there is going to be a significant amount of drop in price, because now you're going to be, if it happened today, for example, they're going to sell that option at $1 and buy the next one, or buy the next VIX futures, whatever they're buying exactly internally, at about 150% more. Therefore, you have a 50% reduction on that little piece right there. And if they're buying it even further out, it's even more expensive. In February, the 14 is at 3.68. Then you go March, 4.5. Now, if you go across, this is probably one of the biggest contangos that we've seen, and maybe also because it's closer to the date of expiration, the December, January. But that's a reason why the VIX ETFs have seen such a dramatic move lower, with really not a equally significant drop in volatility. Where it starts to make a little bit more sense is getting into really the February-March numbers, because the February-March numbers are showing a much lower contango right now. That's at this moment. Now, if everything stays as is, that's going to be the case. Now, everything changes. Oh, okay. So right now, if you bought more of the midterm, if there's a VIX instrument that has a midterm, or you buy longer dated options, you may be a little bit better off. But at the same time, all things considered, as you get closer and closer to the date of expiration, the problem you have is that you're going to see a lot of degradation in the value. One of the problems you see with the VIX instruments is that when you have, or actually any ETF that has a underlying security that has contango, is that when you have that roll, whenever that particular roll happens and the exchange of the move from 1 month to the next, it creates the potential for a significant drawdown. Now, some of that may be baked in. You know, that already has been assumed. So the valuation of the portfolio is whatever it is. But if you see that the near term really drops down and you don't see any real big move of the forward, because the expectation has been heightened that it will move higher from where it is. And with the VIX at relatively, at least near term, midterm lows, the idea that longer term it will move higher is very much a good possibility. And therefore, if you think that longer, from longer dates or out in the future, you're going to see a much greater level of the VIX, then there will be contango. So contango is when, from, let's say, one point, and you have a contract with our futures, let's say, or an option, but a futures contract, let's say that is currently a short-term contract, and the next month is priced higher for the same commodity or, you know, the item, let's say. Well, what you're going to have is you're going to have contango. So you see that has happened with oil for a long time, and you have a situation where longer dated was considered to be more expensive, because they thought was that oil would be going up in the future, and to have the opportunity to buy it sometime in the future will be much more beneficial because it will be rising over time, and that is contango. Now, there are other times where you have backwardation, and backwardation is with just the opposite. When you have a price that is higher now and the expectations are for it to go lower. Now, that may happen in a market that has been really moving higher due to current demand and the thought that there would be a long-term increase in demand like you're seeing now is highly improbable. When you have that kind of situation, you have a much greater benefit to portfolios that are managed like these, and like many of these are, where you have just short-term futures or options in a portfolio, and you have to keep on rolling those. And as you keep rolling those, you're going to get a better price on it. So there's naturally, when you have backwardation, you're going to have naturally a nice benefit. That doesn't happen that often. But all you have to do is look at the price of the same strike price or the same future this month, and let's say the month after and the month after, and see where the price trend is going. Actually, use a few months. See where the price trend is going and see what is going to be working inside of an ETF portfolio, because they're pretty much bound by what they are doing. Now, when we look at commodities, for example, you know, you see gold is just really taking it on the chin, silver as well. It does have those fits and spurts on the upside, but clearly the trend has been to the downside. And Goldman Sachs recently put out a piece, and they've been talking about this for a little while, but they really hammered it home, I believe, last week, that they're looking at commodities, and they're seeing significant amount of demand wane and the potential for gold, silver, as well as other commodities, but really focusing on gold to a point, that the pricing will come down. Now, when Goldman is doing that kind of talk, and you're seeing them really push the envelope in terms of their opinions, I would bet that they're not long the position. Right? Does that make sense? They're probably short the position or out of the position. More likely short. Now, they'll probably stay with that call until it gets to a price that they think that it's worthwhile buying, where it becomes a price that they're interested in. And then, you know, we'll hear about it late, of course, that they switched over, and then they'll rock the markets to the upside. But right now, they have been cooing for a while about this whole potential drop for precious metals. And that has been really playing out pretty well. In fact, John Paulson, who has been the poster child for getting just absolutely obliterated on the gold trade, has been talking about his gold portfolio, and just this weekend said that he is no longer recommending adding to that because of the excess volatility, et cetera, and he's not adding any of his own money to that. I think it's down, that hedge fund that buys gold-related stocks, miners, et cetera, and prices in gold is down, I think, 63% this year. That's a lot. So when you look at the combination of the concern where inflation around the world is actually leaning towards deflationary predictions, which is pretty amazing considering all the stimulus that's being put out there, gold and silver just don't have that much of a case. I don't know what's going to make it really become a much more popular instrument or finally just break down and take out those lows and just really get crushed to a point that there's some value for somebody. But it doesn't look like it's right now. So the big question right now is, where do we go from here? Talk about the VIX being at a relative low. We're talking about gold being just pushed aside. Investor enthusiasm very high and their bearishness very low. The Fed questionably involved, and the economy slowing. So one of the things I wanted to look at was, what are the valuations look like around the world? What are we seeing in terms of the price earnings ratios, just as a quick guide to see what the overall markets look like around the world? Because earnings, of course, are extremely important when it comes to valuations of any particular stock or market. But as you know, I don't really like to single out the PE ratio when it comes to individual stocks, because I don't think it's a fair fight. You can't do a real good comparison of one stock with that one particular ratio, because you're not seeing anything compared to it. It looks at the PE ratio of that stock, and you know, that may be a growth stock, a value stock, that may be a utility. It's just not right to look at that one ratio. But when it comes to a market, a broad-based market, you can see a little bit differently what the valuation is, because the constituent list is broad and you have a long-term history to take a look at. Now, again, it's not the only measure, because this is only talking about the broad-based markets, and it may have an effect on the underlying. Of course, about 70% of stocks trade with the general trend of the market. And you have to look at this with just the idea of, okay, this is an initial glance, and really, okay, what is it telling me in terms of the valuation comparatively? So take a look at this. The S&P is now trading at 17 times earnings. That's getting towards the high point. If you look at the case, or excuse me, the Shiller 10 PE ratio that they calculate, when you go back in history and you look at what the level of the current PE ratio is when you calculate it according to the Shiller 10, there is an amazing number that comes up. It's in the 90th percentile at the top of all historic readings back to the 1800s, or 1900, right at the beginning of the year of the century, last century, of all PE ratios. In other words, we're really hitting the top end of where the PE ratio done by Shiller is ever been. And we're really seeing that at the same time, the S&P is also, just on a raw basis, close to highs when it comes to, it's not the highest by any chance. Of course, we saw that in a couple of different times when earnings just went off the cliff, or when you saw that pricing went crazy and parabolic back in 2000. But when we look at the NASDAQ, that's currently trading at a 24 PE. More interesting is the European stock index, the Euro stocks, is at 17.25, which I thought that was really kind of significant. The Nikkei is trading at 22. The Nikkei is at 22. Hopeful that earnings will come back, I guess. Hang Seng's at 10.75. Brazil's at 62. Now, this is interesting. In Europe, the CAC, the France index, is at an 18.5, and Spain's at 55. Australia is also pretty high in the mid-20s. What is that telling us? Well, you could look at it a couple different ways. You could say, well, if there is all these really high valuations, let's stay away from those and go to the lower. And in the broad scheme of things, the S&P looks pretty good. Well, yes and no. You have to also look at the historical comparatives of the S&P, and I think that puts it in the higher range, because every country has its own relative valuation as well. But overall, I still think that the Japanese markets are terribly overpriced. They really haven't moved very much in the last number of months. They've kind of been jostling around a pretty wide range. But the Hang Seng, questionable. I mean, it all depends on how much oversight and restrictions and regulations the government puts on in terms of their housing, which they're definitely doing a lot more work on right now. Europe, I got to tell you, Europe is getting towards a point that is relatively, I would say, fully valued for the most part. Now, one of the things that Europe did, I think this is important to note, is that we saw just a bizarre comment out of Draghi last week. I mean, very, I would say it's close to shocking, where out of nowhere, the comment, he mentioned, well, we may look for negative interest rates, negative deposit rates in the future. We're working on that. Whoa, wait a minute. Now we're talking about you dropping interest rates down by 25 basis points, which is going to pretty much drop the yen pretty well against the U.S. dollar. Okay, fine. We know why you're doing that. We know that, obviously, the southern countries in Europe are still seeing a lot of problems, and you need to make accommodations. And because the euro was rising for some time, you got to do what you can to bang this down to make Europe more competitive. Okay. Now, let's see what else we got. We have now this crazy notion that you can have negative deposit rates. So let me explain what that means. When banks put money on deposit, their excess reserves, money they're holding to make sure that they have enough money to meet all of their various requirements in terms of loan to value and value at savings, and they have excess money. It's just the way it goes. When they have excess money, they may deposit it at the Fed or the ECB, and that's considered safe money because it's guaranteed, and as opposed to maybe lending it out at a higher rate, but still the risk is there, and they don't want to risk that money. So essentially what they're getting is a very low risk or no risk investment, or at least a place to hold the money. Well, if you increase that and you say, you know, if you're going to hold money here, we're going to charge you. We're going to charge you a 0.25%. If you leave money on deposit at the Fed or at the ECB, what does that do? Well, it changes the dynamic, and the hope is that the banks would have less money on deposit, and thereby they would take that money and make use of it by putting it into the economy through loans and through other means that they would potentially make some more money on. Now, the problem is it brings up the risk characteristics significantly. It could bring up the risk for the banks, that is, because they're going to put it out there in the street. But it also changes the dynamic in terms of the amount of money that is being borrowed by individuals and their overall credit. Because now you'll have banks that have much lower standards, because they're going to, in order to lend, and why they're not lending as much, because they raise their standards. Does that make sense? They raise the standard on who they're going to lend to. Thereby, if there is lending demand or borrowing demand, they at this point have a certain amount that they're going to actually lend to, because only a certain amount will qualify. If, in fact, they are, quote unquote, forced through some means to lend more money, the only way they could do that is lowering their lending standards. So now we have more money on the street, lower lending standards. What does that spell out to you? It spells out a growing economy that, unless it gets over the edge, over the ridge, I should say, not the edge, but over the ridge, if it gets over that point, well, that's great. You have economic expansion, and then from there, probably you have the creditors or the lenders, the people who are borrowing money, their lending rating or ranking goes up because they can pay bills because they have a job, etc. But if you don't crest, if you don't get beyond that, what happens is that you have another potential major problem on your hands. Now, how far can the ECB, how far can they go? How much can they handle in terms of the bad debt that's on the books? Can this go on forever? Is it true that we can never have a meltdown like we had before? Because the ECB, the central banks around the world, have learned exactly what to do in order to really monitor all this. Well, we said that back 25, 30 years ago and 15 years ago. Look at all the banking crises we've seen before and all the different meltdowns we've seen for one reason or another. Now, they don't always take the same shape or size, but they do have a lot of similarities. A lot of them are focused on the banking sector when they get too aggressive, and they're doing a good job not doing that these days, but it's when they get too aggressive. There's too much money in the system. Bubbles form. In the form of property, you're already seeing that in London, the London area, there are sealed bid quotes going on because there is so much demand for housing there. You're seeing that housing demand in certain areas around the U.S. is getting a little bit overheated, to speak truly. And you're seeing an amazing amount of multifamily homes go up. So now if there was too many homes previously, that the supply was so great, pricing was so out of control, and when the pricing came down, there was still so many excess houses available that had to be foreclosed on, etc. And now what we're building is not only houses, but multifamily houses. Isn't there going to be a supply glut on the markets? Now, maybe people that had foreclosed on their homes in certain areas will be relocating because they may not have had the opportunity to do so before. They may not have been able to say, okay, you know what? I'm just going to pick up and go because they had roots, they had a house, et cetera. But now they foreclosed, they don't have a house, they don't have anything. Hey, let's go down to Florida. Let's go to North Carolina. Let's go to California. Let's go to Texas. Let's go to somewhere we wanted to live, maybe warmer, whatever. Maybe they want to go to Canada. Who knows where they want to go? But the point is that they have the opportunity to do so. And certain areas that are more appealing may see a much greater amount of home is being built and population growth. And at the same time, you know, I always say this, and I'm going to say it again. You haven't heard me say this a long time. Developers are like puppy dogs. Puppy dogs are said to eat until they puke. Developers will build until they just, you know, have nothing else to build, no more money, and they just collapse, and then they'll come back again. That's how it goes. I've seen it 100 times. Same thing with, you know who else, what other industry does this? Mortgage refinancing companies. There's a company that will form, and if you're in the mortgage business, you know what I'm talking about. You'll form a company, and you'll start refinancing. Refinancing will be slow and doing its thing, and you'll be building your company and hopefully getting some names. And then next thing you know, wow, refinancing's really hitting stride. You get new mortgages, new refinancing, and then you decide, wow, we're out of room. We got to hire more people. You expand. You expand and you expand and you expand. You think this is going to last forever to a point where you have so much space and you're really cranking. Next thing you know, mortgage is slow and you're like, what happened? Well, it's a cycle. There's only so much people can refinance their mortgages. There's only so many mortgages that people will take in an area. Only a certain amount of houses that we built and houses sold. You could try to keep that going. Say, well, when they're not refinancing, they're buying. When they're not buying, they may be refinancing. And you get those ebbs and flows. But usually what you see is a spurt. And invariably, the mortgage companies, what they do is they expand and expand and expand. My advice has always been, do me a favor, don't expand. Figure out some technology, figure out something where you can even have some part-timers on, but do not expand the offices to this monstrosity of space, because there's going to be a time that's going to see a very significant drop in refinancings and in the work that you're going to do, and you're going to have to lay off people, and then you're going to be stuck with this big office. Time and time this happens. I'm not kidding. Time and time this happens. I've seen it tons of times. I've told people about this many, many times, and if you're in the mortgage business, you're probably shaking your head and you're agreeing with me, because this is what happens. This is what's called economic cycles. We get hungry, we eat, we fill up, we get so happy and so full, and then we get exhausted and tired and we don't want to see food ever again. And then all of a sudden, you know what? In a period of time, we get hungry again and we start the cycle all over. This is what happens with the economy. Certain sectors as well. Certain sectors are worse than others. And don't believe that we're not going to see some crisis in the future. It may not be today. It may not be very deep. But you know what? You always make sure to plan that there is something around the corner that you're not aware of, because we're not aware of what's around the corner. That's the fact. All right, getting back to a couple other things. This also just ties into one last point about this. Are there bubbles forming? Bubbles are getting overused. The word is definitely overused. Let's talk about high valuations, excessive exuberance. I think we have a little bit of excessive exuberance right now in the U.S. equity markets for whatever reason. The companies are, you've seen companies that have come out and they have better numbers maybe this quarter than expected. Of course, we saw a lot of analysts guiding lower, but they have come out with guidance that's a lot lower. Now, investors, what do they do? They say, wow, oh, wait a minute. I'm going to do a little calculation here, and they're guiding lower and all that, and the analysts do the same thing, and stock maybe fades down a little bit. And then recently, the attitude has been, all right, you know what? It's down 3%, let's buy it. Or it's up 10%, let's sell it. You've seen this on a regular basis where you have a stock that really does very well for 1 or 2 days, and then it just reverses down, not all the way, I mean, but it definitely takes back a lot of profits, because that is the excessive amount of exuberance that you're seeing. On the other side, you're seeing when a stock is dropping and it comes up again, excessive amount of exuberance is that differential. Green Mountain Coffees, by the way, they beat, and there's been a lot of negativity on that stock. So you saw a drop off over the last, I don't know, pretty bad chart actually. Dropped off from about 85 to 60s. And then it was up about 16% the day after their recent earnings because it was better. But they're guiding much lower. Now, one of the things is that they had lower coffee prices. That was good. Very good. Very good. They had a little bit better sales. Okay, that was good. But they're guiding lower. All right, they're putting in a dividend and a reinvestment plan and a buyback plan, I mean. All right, that's good. But they're guiding lower. So, what does that mean? What do we do? Well, right now, because a lot of this information is taken as the cup is three-quarters of the way full, not even half full, you just ride it, I guess, in a certain way, and you kind of play either side of it on certain things if you're trading. If you're investing, okay, well, you ride it out for a while. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. Look at on Friday, we saw that there was a major move in Biogen, about a 13% move. That's pretty good for that stock. We own that stock. And what happened? Well, there was a approval on one of the drugs or slash biotechs that they have, and that was taken very well by investors. I was pretty surprised it moved up that hard. I mean, that was a pretty good move for that stock. On the other hand, you have a disappointment in a stock. For example, last week, there was an announcement that the EPA is going to be suggesting, I think I mentioned this, that there should be a lower standard, lower amount of ethanol to oil in gasoline, and therefore this particular stock, let's say call it renewable energy, REGI, dropped off like 20%. Seems a little excessive because it's just a blueprint right now, and you wonder if the EPA, even though they have a lot of say, and of course the environmental issues, if it's going to be voted on and actually approved. I'm pretty surprised, actually. After, you know, they're all for it, and corn is like goes through the roof, and, you know, you have the fact that ethanol prices obviously are tied to corn. And then at the same time, corn prices, you know, cut in half. and they're not for it. It just seems a little bit absurd to me. I mean, ethanol, obviously, too much ethanol in the mixture is really bad for your engine. We all know that. If you have any jet skis or boats, you really know that. Maybe even motorcycles. I have a jet ski and a boat, and you got to put in all sorts of little things, and you get these warnings, and you have to be careful. There's a lot of gas stations on the lake that I go to that have ethanol-free or non-ethanol gas, and that, if you have the choice, you want to put that into your jet ski. It just doesn't like the ethanol. There's a corrosion or something it does. But the point is that I find it very interesting that now we are seeing that there is a move towards this by the EPA. Again, makes no sense. The KRI, the key reversal indicator, I find it really kind of fascinating that the last few days it hasn't really budged. It's about 0 to 1. We saw it up to about a 2. It was up positive 4 a few weeks back. We saw the markets roll over a little bit, then come right back, and we're back in equilibrium now. We've really never seen for a while now a negative number, which is very interesting, and obviously that's the buying pressure that we're seeing. But we're at a 0 right now, marking an equilibrium, which generally means that the trend will continue at least until you see a move in that, because there is a significant amount of power behind the trend, or the trend is not to a point of exhaustion. Now, I would venture to say that the next move that we see, if it is further upside, you're going to see some very steep move in the KRI, because basically, you know, we're at a point that we are at the highs for the Dow, for the S&P 500. We're getting towards the end of the year, and the volume will thin out with a light week ahead of us, you know, before Thanksgiving, and the moves can be exacerbated, which will then push some of the indications higher for the key reversal index indicator. I will keep you abreast of that and put it on the disciplinedinvestor.com as well. And next week, I am going to bring you some real turkey stocks. It's going to be right after Thanksgiving. But I'm going to bring you some stocks that are real turkeys and some things that you may want to be looking at that have hit highs that maybe shouldn't have, and the potentially to looking at them from the opposite side of the long and look at the, you know, maybe some things to be aware of. I also want to mention, before we go, a couple of things. I have a couple of things on my list here. That, of course, thank you for your emails. AskAndrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Very helpful. Always sending me interesting items to take a look at. And also the fact is that towards the end of the year, I want to kind of wrap up some of the best that we've done and some of the things that you could advise. Now, I want you to do me a favor with this. Suggestions. Now, we've been doing this for a number of years now, and very successfully. People really continually write me how much they like the show. I get a little, every time I talk about politics, I get something from somebody that's just all pissed off at me about something. But what I want you to do me a favor. Please send me a note to AskAndrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. What would you like more of? What would you like less of? Who would you like to hear more? Changes in the show? Because I can't, you know, and we can't, think of everything that you want if we don't hear from you. This is all about a communication and help for you. That's why I do it. I really love doing this. But you know what? If we're not hitting those ideas that you think are important for whatever reason, maybe we can. Maybe we can bring in some people. Like right now, we're looking for Larry McMillan to be coming on. And he's an expert in options and the VIX, to ask him some questions and to clarify some of these things that we've been talking about. We've had, you know, Harry Dent on. We've had Frank Curzio on quite often. John Markman. I mean, the list goes on. But you know what? Maybe there's a pro that you know. Maybe there's something. Maybe you'd want to hear something more about, like we had somebody on about taxes recently. You know, maybe that was something that really interested you. Or maybe you didn't. Maybe you want to hear about, hey, how to build a computer to do trading. You know, maybe you want to hear some more technical items that will be helpful. Maybe you want to deal with more of a long-term nature. What about a section on mutual funds? I don't know. I'm just thinking. So anything that you want, please do me a favor. Seriously, send me a note to AskAndrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Now, one more thing I want to mention to you. This is important. If you want to be on the list to first receive when a podcast is produced, when there's a news item or a publication of research that we put out, what I want you to do is very easy. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. At the top right, there's a place that you put your name and your email. That's it. That's all you do. Name, email. And when you do that, you'll be on the list. You could also follow me on Twitter, and the handle is Andrew Horowitz, one word. Andrew Horowitz. Now, you'll get alerts on Twitter for DH Unplugged. You'll get a variety of other small interim alerts. You'll get when the podcast comes out. You'll get when a post is published on the Disciplined Investor. So you'll get one from on DH Unplugged as well. And you'll get some other things from Trigger Point Research. You know, that's kind of cool. You can keep in touch with all of them. It all goes right into the Twitter stream. So that's kind of neat. So if you want any of that, you know, make sure to go over to Twitter. It's very easy. I'll stay on hold until you do it. Andrew Horowitz is the name. Andrew Horowitz, at Andrew Horowitz, is just subscribe to it. Or go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and in the top right there, just do me a favor, put your name and your email, and the system will automatically send you the information that is published on a regular basis. So this way that if you miss something during the time, well, you'll have it right in your email available for you. Well, thanks for joining me. I wish you and your family a wonderful Thanksgiving. And next week, remember, we're going to have plenty of turkey ideas and leftovers for you to chew on and think about. Thanks for joining me again. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing. We'll be right back.